Hello, my name is Rob Bennett. I'm the author of a book entitled Passion Saving, The Path to Plentiful Free Time and Soul-Satisfying Work. I'm also the publisher of the PassionSaving.com website, and I'm working on a second book entitled Investing for Humans, How to Get What Works on Paper to Work in Real Life. This is podcast number 91. I'm recording it on Tuesday, February 3rd, 2009. The PE10 level today is 14. That's fair value. Stocks purchased at today's prices offer a strong long-term value proposition. The music for the podcast is by Kevin McLeod of Incompetech.com. This selection is called On the Cool Side. The podcast is entitled Blame It on Ayn Rand, Blame It on the Libertarians. Just to give you a little bit of background for the benefit of the newcomers, the PassionSaving.com website advocates a model of investing called rational investing. Rational investing is a rejection of the dominant model for understanding how stock investing works, which is called passive investing. Passive investing argues you don't need to change your stock allocation, even when stocks go to insanely dangerous price levels. Those who advocate rational investing argue that that makes no sense, and that you must adjust your stock allocation, not often, but every 8 or 10 years, when prices change dramatically. When prices are at insanely high levels, you need to lower your stock allocation, as they were from 1995 through the first part of 2008. I further argue that our entire economic crisis today has been caused by the popularity of passive investing. That middle-class investors today invest in the stock market to achieve their financial freedom goals, to finance their retirements. And many people chose their stock allocations thinking either at times when prices were reasonable or thinking at times when they were not reasonable that they were. But if you choose a stock allocation that makes sense at a time when prices are reasonable, that allocation is going to be wildly reckless at the sorts of price levels that applied from 1995 through the first part of 2008. So many people were going with stock allocations of 60% or 70% or, heaven help us all, 80%, when they should have been going with stock allocations of 10% or 20% or perhaps 30% in some cases. So millions and millions and millions of us were wildly overinvested in stocks, and that caused stock prices to reach just levels that had never been seen before in the history of the United States, far, far above the levels that caused the Great Depression of the late 1920s. We went far, far higher than that this time because of the popularity of this passive investing idea. The passive investing idea came to be, well, I don't want to go through the whole history of it, but it's rooted in academic research. It's rooted in an intellectual construct referred to as the efficient market theory. And the efficient market theory, just to be very brief about it, says that the market always sets the right price. This is why we're told we're told the timing never works, or you don't need to change your stock allocation when prices get out of control. The reason we are told those things, or that stocks are always the best investment class for the long run, the reason we are told those things is, is that all of that is consistent with the efficient market theory. The efficient market theory says the stock price is always right. Essentially, it says that the market is always rational, it's always efficient, investors are always rational, and there really is no such thing as overvaluation. If the market says that's the price, that's the price, that's what it should be. So there would never be any reason for changing your stock allocation if the price is always right. When that idea becomes popular, it's like taking the brake off of a car. The normal way for the market to proceed is that people would invest in stocks when the long-term value proposition was good, when the long-term when stocks prices got too high and the long-term value proposition became poor, people would lower their stock allocations and the market would self-adjust. We would never get into these sort of situations we've been in recent years. But when the passive investing could also be called emotional investing. It's a purely emotional approach. Not advertised that way, but that's what it is when it's scrutinized. That's what you see it is when it's scrutinized. When a purely emotional approach becomes wildly popular, as passive investing did in the 1980s and 1990s, and through today, it's still popular today, despite its failures, prices just go to dangerous levels, and what happens ultimately is that it causes a stock crash, and when the prices are too far out of control, it can actually cause a collapse of the entire economy. And that's what we're threatened with today. That's what we were threatened with in the 1920s when the PE10 level got to 2x fair value. Stocks weren't a little overvalued in the late 1920s. They were double. Fair value is a PE10 level of 14 or 15. The stocks went to a PE10 level of 33 in the late 1920s. Extremely dangerous. Not a little bit of overvaluation. Double. In the late 1990s, we went to 44. We went to 3x fair value. So we're now in a worse situation than we were, at least in terms of stock valuations, we're in a worse situation than we were in the late 1920s. And we are now in the process of trying to work that out. The big problem we have, the big opportunity we have, is that we have learned things about stock investing that we never knew before. Both in the passive investing era, when we were learning, when we started using academic research to learn how stock investing works, the people who advocate passive investing have indeed come up with some wonderful ideas. The idea of investing for the long term is a wonderful idea. The idea of limiting costs, the idea of using index funds to invest is a wonderful idea. The idea of ignoring the short-term noise, all kinds of wonderful ideas. However, the passive investing idea has caused this horrible economic crisis. So the opportunity is, what if we were to abandon passive investing, adopt rational investing, accept the idea that yes, that there's a point at which prices are so insane that we simply must adjust our stock allocations in order to have any hope of being successful long-term investors. But what if we were to hold on to all the good ideas and then supplement them with reasonable ideas on the stock allocation question? That would bring in the golden age of middle-class investing, and I believe that would get our economy back on its feet. But despite the fact that academic research now shows that valuations do affect long-term returns, that passive investing can never work in the real world. And we have research on that going back to 1981, done by Robert Shiller and many others. What if we were to tell people about all that wonderful research? What if we were to tell them passive investing was a mistake? It doesn't work. We thought that it worked. There were people who thought that it worked, very smart people. But they made a mistake. They jumped to hasty conclusions based on preliminary findings. That would be the answer to our problem. But what we've seen for the first 7 years of discussions in the retire early and indexing discussion board communities, discussions that are collectively referred to as the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate Debate, we've seen great reluctance on the part of passive investing dogmatists to acknowledge the errors of this model. Most community members have shown an interest. We've seen great interest in learning about these ideas. But a small group of highly abusive posters have blocked the discussions everywhere we've attempted to hold them. So that's where we stand today. Now, I'm always trying to come to a better understanding of what is the problem. Why can we not get from where we are, which is a very bad place, to where we all would like to be, a wonderful place, where we all invest more effectively, we all achieve financial freedom earlier in life, many years sooner. It's not as if we're dealing with a situation here where, you know, there are winners and losers. Switching to rational investing would cause some people to get ahead and others to fall back. This is all winners. Any person who has any money at all in the stock market is a winner by learning how to invest more effectively, by learning how to obtain higher returns with lower risk. So what is the holdup? What is the problem? What is the obstacle? I have more and more, I have come to believe, this podcast is going to be a bit tentative, but sometimes those are the most important ones, because when you discuss ideas that you're not sure of yet, you're stretching your mind a little bit. So I don't feel sure of everything I say in this podcast, but I've been toying with these ideas in the back of my mind for months. And I'm becoming more and more convinced that there's something there. And I want to think them through a little more carefully. And one of the ways I do that is by talking about them on a podcast. I think that what is going on is we're dealing with an ideology. We're dealing with an ideology. We're not really dealing with an investing strategy. We're dealing with an ideology, and they're not at all the same thing. Ideology, I don't know what the dictionary definition is exactly, but an ideology is how I think of it. I'll describe how I think of it. An ideology is when you believe in something, but this belief you have comes to dominate your thinking on a whole host of questions. So, for example, Marxism is an ideology. If you buy into Marxism, you start seeing every question that appears before you in terms of Marxist principles. Capitalism is an ideology. Many people, whatever goes wrong in the world, you know, their answer is the free market could handle that. Or if something goes bad, they say, well, that's because there's too many restrictions on the free market. Liberalism is an ideology. Many people, in response to our economic problems today, will say the problem is we don't have enough government regulation. You know, government needs to step in. We all have ideologies. The ideology becomes a bad word when it becomes extreme. But we have to have a set of beliefs in order to get through the day. You have to have some sort of ideology. Religions, I think, are a form of ideology. If you're a Catholic, you tend to view the world through a certain prism, and you tend to address all questions in terms of what your faith, how your faith informs you. I may not be going strictly by the dictionary definition, but I think that's the general idea. The core idea is that whatever your thinking is on the ideology influences your thinking on all sorts of questions. And ideology, I don't think it has to be a bad thing, but it often is used as a bad thing. Often when you accuse someone of being ideological, you're saying that they're extremists, that they're narrow-minded, that they're not open to hearing other points of views because they're too caught up in their ideology. Ideology itself, I don't think, is necessarily a bad thing, because you have to have a framework by which you explore questions. If you started every question you looked at from the ground up, you would never get anything done. You'd spend all day looking at just the tiniest little question, you know, should I cross the street at the corner or in the middle of this block? And you would be debating it for hours, you know, trying to get all the different data points to figure out what to do. If your ideology is, you know, I mean, I don't know if it's an ideology of safety, but if your ideology is statistically the risk of something happening is small and you have to take certain chances to get through life, you're just going to make your decision and you're going to cross in the middle of the street. Or if your ideology is never break a rule, you might say, well, that's jaywalking. I'm going to go to the corner and cross there. And these things, I'm giving a silly example, a facetious example, but the truth is different people do make different decisions as to whether to cross in the middle of the street or to cross at the corner. If you look at two different people, or if you're reading a novel and they describe a character, different characters, different personalities will come to different questions. Different points of view on even that sort of question. They really do. People with different ideologies dress differently. They dress differently. Some people dress more formally and some less formally. They speak differently. They walk differently. They obviously date differently. They eat differently. They like different sorts of entertainment. In other words, our mental framework influences everything. When we think of investing advice, we don't think of these questions coming into play. I certainly didn't prior to May 13th, 2002, that fateful day when I put forward the post that kicked off the Great Safe Withdrawal Rate debate back at the Motley Fool board. And I don't think most other middle-class investors think of investing advice as being a matter of ideology. They think of it as being practical. They think of it as, I have money, I have to invest it, I need some advice, does anybody have any good ideas on what I should do with it? And they turn to quote-unquote experts, and the experts say what they think, and everyone just assumes the experts are just reporting what they know. There's no thought of it going through the prism of an ideology. More and more and more, I believe that's not so. Passive investing is an ideology. And it has its good side. I'm a harsh critic of passive investing. I like to think that I'm the most severe critic of passive investing alive today. And I think that's fair. You know, if you listen to the podcast, you will hear me take strong positions against passive investing. Stronger than Robert Shiller. Robert Shiller's the master in the work he's done showing the flaws of passive investing, but I think my criticism goes to a new level because of experiences I've had with my fellow community members on different discussion boards. What I've seen what passive investing does not only to people's portfolio returns, I've seen what it does to them as people, and so it's sort of a different focus of criticism. And of course, I've seen what it does to the economy as a whole in the recent months. We've seen this economic destruction. I think it would be fair to say that the passive investing concept has caused more human misery than any other idea in the history of personal finance. That's how strongly I feel. So there's obviously something about this passive investing idea that robs Rob Bennett the wrong way. And I think what it is that it is so intensely ideological. And of course, it's all hidden. We don't think of it as being ideological at all. We think of it as just being an investing strategy. But there is an ideology buried in the passive investing concept. That ideology, if I were going to reduce it to a phrase, I would call it laissez-faire, laissez-faire capitalism. Now, many of the people who advocate passive investing, I don't think, believe in laissez-faire capitalism. They don't know that they're adopting this ideology when they adopt the passive investing concept, but they are, or at least so I maintain. I've had people contact me at the website. I've had on discussion boards, I've had people support me who were far left. I've had people support me who were far right. I've had people criticize me who were far left, and I've had people criticize me who are far right. So I don't think of the ideas I put forward on investing as being ideological. And it's also true of passive investing. In other words, there are people who support and oppose passive investing from all sides of the political spectrum. So I don't think in objective terms it's that there's much political content to it. I don't have that feeling. I don't know what John Bogle's political views are. I recall reading that Warren Buffett was advising President Obama. So I believe that Warren Buffett supported the campaign, the Obama campaign. So that means he's a Democrat, or at least sometimes votes Democrat. I recall reading a headline about who Buffett was supporting in the election, and I think I saw it at a discussion board. I didn't click on it because I wasn't interested enough to find out. Now I sort of wish I had found out, but I don't know. But, you know, the impression you get with Bogle is that, and I get this impression with Buffett as well, is just that they're both sort of, I would describe them both as moderates in the way they present themselves. I don't know their politics, but they present themselves as being either moderate liberal or moderate conservative. But I don't know for sure. As I say, I don't not know. It's just pure speculation. But laissez-faire capitalism is a fairly extreme point of view. Today, the United States was a laissez-faire capitalist society before the New Deal. And I recall reading when I was in law school, I recall reading some legal cases. It was a big sort of legal issue. We had been a laissez-faire capitalist society, and all our laws were rooted in laissez-faire. Laissez-faire just means, I think, I don't know exactly what it means literally. It essentially means let it be. Government is not to be involved. Let it be. So that was written into our legal system, and it was, after the Depression, we turned to the New Deal as a government response, and the government got involved in just about every aspect of life to a greater extent than it had been before. And there were some who argued that this was, you know, against the Constitution or against the laws or whatever. And there were all these sorts of battles that went on, and some of them went on in the courts. And I recall reading cases where it was considered somewhat shocking that these laissez-faire ideas were being defeated. There's a sense in which passive investing is a throwback to that. It's taken me a long time to see this. Now, the connecting thread is libertarianism. And so the title of the podcast is Blame It on Ayn Rand, Blame It on Libertarianism. I have a long relationship in my life, not a personal relationship, but a relationship with the thinking of Ayn Rand. And she's sort of a ghost that appears in my life at different times. So I'll tell a little bit of that story, but I don't want to spend too long on that riff because I want to pull it back to the ideology behind passive investing. But when I was a boy, I was maybe in, my guess is 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, those sorts of years, maybe first year high school, those years, I used to, we didn't have as much money then, you know, as kids do today. I look at how many Legos my boys have, and it makes me sick. It makes me sick to my stomach. They just have bins and bins of these Legos. But in those days, I used to like, you know, record albums. That's the main thing I wanted to spend money on. And books. I like to buy books and record albums. And I got a small allowance. It was very small. And I would just save up my money. But I would go to Corvettes. There was a department store called Corvettes. And it was about a 25-minute walk from my house. And I liked to walk. So once a week or so, I would walk there. And I'd spend maybe an hour just looking at the books and sometimes looking at the records and sometimes at the books. And I would look at all, I couldn't buy many records. I could buy the Beatles maybe, and that was about all I could buy. But I can remember looking at, everything that came out. I would just look at them and try to figure out what they were about. And The Who would come out with an album, or Janis Joplin, or Creedence Clearwater. And I would look them over. And I can remember, I have memories, you know, to this day, of standing there at Corvettes and looking over the album cover and trying to figure out if there was a single out, The Doors, you know. If there was a single out, I would know. I would have some idea what the record was about. If there wasn't, I just had a guess. But I would just look. I enjoyed that. It was sort of window shopping for me. But the book section was right next to the record section. So I would drift over there. And I can remember they used to always have this book out. And it was Atlas Shrugged, and that was Ayn Rand's big novel. And I didn't know who Ayn Rand was. I had no idea. And I couldn't figure out from the title what the book was about. You know, Atlas Shrugged. There are a lot of companies with the name Atlas in them, and I thought it had must have something to do with tires or something. There must be a tire company with Atlas in it, and I thought, is this a book about tires? You know, what is it about? And I couldn't figure it out, but I could tell there was something about it. The way they promoted it, there was something there. And Ayn Rand became very popular in the 60s. She wrote earlier than that. Her book was published, I think it might have been early 50s, but I'm not sure. But she became popular in the 60s. She was, and it's strange in a way because, I don't know, she's hard to classify. She's not, she certainly wasn't, she was very out of tune with a lot of what was going on in the 60s. Maybe she was popular because she was criticizing it. I don't know, but there was some weird dynamic there. But see, libertarianism is always a weird dynamic. Libertarianism, if you know, not everybody knows, but libertarianism, it is in a way a throwback to laissez-faire, the government getting out of everything. And Ayn Rand, she wrote novels. She also wrote nonfiction, but she was famous for her novels. But she was greatly critical of government. And she was also critical of Christianity. So you couldn't, you know, some would classify her as being on the left because she was against Christianity, which all these things are generalizations, but to some extent that's viewed as being on the left, although there obviously are people on the left who are Christian. And some would view her as being on the right because she was against government involvement in the economy. And this is what libertarians are. They're neither left nor right according to the standard delineation, because they're extreme conservative on economic issues and extreme liberal on social issues, as a generalization. These are generalizations. But after seeing that book at Corvettes, you know, I just forgot about it. And then years later, when I was in law school, I was seeing a girl, and she would take me into these. She was trying to. She did a good job. She exposed me to a lot of cultural things I didn't know about. She took me to a lot of good movies. But she was taking me to a bookshop, a used bookshop. And I was there, and the, you know, I was looking around the books, and I see Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged again. I'm like, what is that? You know, here's that book again. And it was written for a dollar. It was, you know, written down to a dollar because it was used. And so I said, for a dollar, you know, I'll figure out what this darn book is about. And I picked it up and I got in line. And it was amazing. But there was this guy just ahead of me, and he got all upset. And he was very upset. And he was saying, why are you getting that book? And I said, well, I don't know. I used to see it at Corvettes. And I figured for a dollar, you know, I'll read a few pages, see if I like it or not. He says, well, it's not worth a dollar. You know, put it back. You don't want to read that book. And I'm like, oh. But the amazing thing was he actually persuaded me. He was so strong in his views. I said, well, maybe it really is a bad book. You know, maybe I should put it back. And I put it back. And then, but it always gnawed at me that I had allowed this guy to talk me out of getting the book and why he was so upset about it. And so, again, years later, it might have been 5-10 years later, I finally just said, I'm gonna get a copy of that book and I'm gonna read it. Find out what people are so upset about. And I read it and I liked it a lot. I liked Atlas Shrugged. But I'm not a libertarian, I don't buy into it all, but I thought it was a very good book. And it was a strange book in that it was not popular with critics as a rule. A lot of critics hated it. But it was very popular with the public. It sold large numbers of copies. It sold by word of mouth. Same thing's true of The Fountainhead, Ayn Rand's other famous novel. And there's a wonderful scene in Atlas Shrugged, a wonderful chapter where she's describing this. This is what I liked about Ayn Rand. But she had a chapter about a train wreck, and it was basically two trains coming opposite directions, and they were supposed to switch one train off, but because of all sorts of, I don't know, bureaucratic mess-ups, miscommunications, they were not going to have the train switched off, so they both were going to be on the same track, headed towards each other head on. And there's a whole chapter, a long chapter, where the protagonist in the novel, I think it was Dagny, I can't remember her last name, Dagny somebody, and you know, she's trying to alert the people to do whatever they have to do. So these strange, but nobody, everybody's just concerned about their little job, you know. So they're all saying, "Oh, it's not my job to worry about that. You know, I just do this thing," and because they're all just worried about their little thing, and they won't pay attention to the big picture. The two trains end up smashing, and I thought that was cool because that sort of thing does happen in real life, and it happened with this stock crash. You know, all the people who understand that valuations affect long-term returns, and it's not a small number of people, it's probably 10% of all investing experts. It's not a small number of people. They all saw this coming years ago. They've just been waiting for it to happen. And they tried warning people, and nobody pays any attention, and they just said, well, I guess we'll just have to let it happen. But now that it's happened, I think the big fear is if we don't do something about it at some point, the whole economy might go off a cliff. Just like, you know, it's like watching these trains collide. It's a frustrating experience to know that something's going to happen and not to be able to do anything about it. So that was what I liked about Ayn Rand. She sort of had the ability to take an idea and to follow it to its logical conclusion, and then to present that in a novelistic form where you can see the idea being dramatized, working out in the real world. So I like that, even though I don't agree with everything she says. But I am not at all, I wouldn't describe myself as being anti-libertarian. I got interested in libertarian ideas. Ayn Rand would technically refer to herself as an objectivist. She developed a philosophy she called objectivism. And so I don't think she ever personally aligned herself with libertarians, but she clearly had sympathies with their political ideas, and lots of libertarians will attribute their conversion, if you want to call it that, to Ayn Rand. So she's certainly associated with the libertarian political ideas. And I got interested in those ideas. But I'm interested in all kinds of ideas, so I'll jump from one thing to another. I like to think about things. I like it when people come at things from a different angle. And libertarians are very good at that. You can learn a lot by reading libertarian literature, because they're not liberal and they're not conservative, and they'll get down to premises. They'll discuss the basics of an issue, the root, and you often come to a different understanding by listening to what they have to say. So I subscribed for a year or two to Reason magazine, which is a libertarian magazine, and Liberty magazine for a while. And there was a guy, Harry Brown, who was an investing analyst, but he ran for president on the libertarian ticket. And I can't recall what year, but he spoke one time in Washington. I went to see him when I was living in Washington. I don't think I voted for him, but I did go to see him. And I used to have a certain interest in libertarian issues, and I had an interest in Ayn Rand too. Never fanatical, I hope. But I'm not unsympathetic to these ideas. But I guess it's hitting me. I keep trying to figure out, what is it about passive investing that people are so intensely dogmatic? Not a little bit. They're stark raving bonkers about it. And not most people. I don't at all mean to say that most investors are. Most investors follow passive investing because the quote-unquote experts advocate it. That's why. But it's the experts are sort of smooth. You know, the people who are really experts don't come across so dogmatically. They try to cover it up. But on discussion boards, of course, people who advocate it, they're not quite as smooth. And they just follow what the experts say. They don't really know why. But there you see real dogmatism, a real unwillingness to look at the flaws of passive investing. And if you ask the experts, and I've done this, the experts get hostile too. They're obviously not as obnoxious, you know, as the abusive posters on discussion boards. But I have seen quote-unquote experts get at least slightly hostile under questioning, when they're asked about why they believe in passive investing. So it is characteristic of this mode of thought. And so one of the things I'm trying to explore, and in general, I don't like it when investing discussions turn to politics, because I think it hurts community. I don't want to cause anything to make any community member feel unwelcome. I want everybody contributing, no matter where they stand on the political spectrum. So I'm generally opposed to political posting on investing boards. But we're in a funny situation now where it's all become melded together. The investing issues and the economic issues and the political issues are all mixed together now, because our mistakes on the investing side caused an economic crash, and the economic crash is being solved with political remedies. So politics and economics and investing are all sort of mixed together in the same pot today. So you can't avoid it totally. And my view, I've stated this in an earlier podcast, I've said that I don't really believe the economic stimulus bill is going to solve the problem. I view that as a sideshow. There may be some good things in it, and there may be some bad things in it, but I don't believe it's going to restore investor confidence. I think the only thing that will restore investor confidence is to explain to people why this happened to them and what they have to do to avoid having it happen again. And that means looking at the problems with passive investing that we've been ducking for 30 years now. But I also don't think, that's sort of a criticism of Obama's lead initiative so far has been the stimulus package. So that's a criticism on that side. But I also have a criticism on the other side that some are saying, no, we don't need this government involvement. We need the free market to work it out. Well, the free market is what got us into this mess. The free market is passive investing. And that's the real point of this podcast. That what we have with passive investing is not, I'm not opposed to free markets, although I guess the point I'm making is that they can't be totally free. We had free markets in this country. We tried it, and it didn't work. And the New Deal was about going to moderate the free market. There's going to be a moderating influence. Government is going to play a moderating influence. And I feel, and I think many others feel this way, that government involvement was not anti-free market, it was pro-free market. Because if we didn't get the government involved in creating the safety net, Social Security and Medicare, Medicaid, these sorts of things, if we didn't get the government involved, the whole system was going to collapse. And if the whole system collapsed, there goes your free market. You don't have a free market anymore. So if you really love free markets, you want free markets that work. And that means there needs to be some balance. And this is, we need to be non-ideological. You can't just say, this is my idea, and I'm going to stick with this idea no matter what. You have to be willing to make adjustments to the ideas to make it workable, to make it livable. And the idea of a free market, there's a lot going for it. There have been many cases where free markets have done great things. But you can't, the words free market don't have a magical power to overcome, every possible problem. And passive investing is, it's a laissez-faire, totally free market, totally unregulated approach to investing. Now, why do I say that? Well, the roots of passive investing, and I may have to study this more. My knowledge is sketchy, but I think my knowledge is basically accurate, but it's sketchy. The passive investing concept comes from something called the Chicago School of Economics. It's a laissez-faire approach to economics. It says, Milton Friedman, I believe, is a big advocate of the Chicago School of Economics. And I think what brought this into my mind is there was just somebody at the Bogleheads board linked to a video where the guy who came up with the efficient market idea was giving a speech. And, you know, they had a presentation, and it was an hour long, and I couldn't listen to the whole thing. I just didn't have the time, and I could tell that it was going to be, you know, Eugene Fama. Eugene Fama was the guy who came up with the efficient market theory, and he was going to speak, and I wanted to hear what he had to say, but the guy who, I got through most of the introduction, and the guy on the introduction was just, he was so ideological. He was sincere. I really felt that he believed what he was saying. But he was ideological. He was painting everything in pro-efficient market theory terms, and it just got to be more than I could take. And, you know, because to me, it was like fingernails on a blackboard. You know, he would sort of address the criticisms of the efficient market theory, but then dismiss them. He would be dismissive of them without really taking them seriously. And that was, I found that annoying. And I finally got to a point where I just felt I couldn't invest more time in it. But that's, of course, characteristic of an ideology. People who believe in an ideology, they don't see the failings of it because they're blind to them. They're, you know, it's like they say, love is blind. When you adopt an ideology, that's all you see. You see the good side and you don't see the bad side. That's the risk. That's a risk of being ideological. That's the downside. But the efficient market theory comes from this Chicago School of Economics. I believe. I need to study it more so I can make more definitive statements, but that's my understanding. It comes from that school of thought. And that school of thought, it has this whole idea that man is a rational being. And so they look at every question. They also do this in politics. I've seen political analysis that came out of the Chicago school or a related school. And they will look at political questions and they'll say, oh, people always do the right thing politically. You know, they can do two opposite things, but whatever they do is right. You know, when they do one thing, that's right. And then when they do the absolute opposite, it's right. They just, the way they do it is that's how they, it's all how you set up your methodology. If you set the methodology up to say whatever people do is right, well, then of course your finding is everything they did was right. And that's just what they do with the efficient market theory. They say, whatever price the market comes to is right, and then they say, now let's examine. Working on the assumption that everything the market does is right, how often is the market right? And they say, look, it was right this time, and it was right. Of course, if you assume it, it's always right. But I swear that's what they do. I mean, they don't see it that way. But there is, the point here is, there is no way to argue with the efficient market theory or with passive investing. It's a tautology. They assume the conclusion. They start out with the assumption. And if you don't believe me, please investigate it on your own. You'll come to one of two conclusions. If you support passive investing, you'll conclude that I'm misstating it, I'm being unfair. If you're one of the critics, and as I say, I am not the only critic of the efficient market theory. Please don't think that I am. If you're one of the critics, you'll agree with everything I'm saying. You'll say, yeah, that's just what they do. What they do is they assume their conclusions. They say that people, it doesn't make sense to think that people wouldn't invest rationally. Therefore, they do. They do invest rationally. And if everybody invests rationally, the market price should be right. It should be efficient. If everybody invests rationally, the market should get it right because the market is just people. And all of that is true except the first premise that people are rational. People are not rational. People are partly rational, of course, but people are also often emotional. And when people are emotional, the market price is always wrong. And the more emotional they are, the more wrong it is. And the really sad, pathetic part is the efficient market theory added emotion to the process. There was always a risk of investors becoming emotional. This has been happening from the beginning of time. That people would get emotional over stocks and prices would get out of hand and we'd suffer stock crashes. But what happened this time is we not only had people getting emotional about stocks, we had an academic theory that said no matter how emotional they got, the price could never be wrong. Stocks for the long run, can't time the market, blah, 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 blee, blee, blee. And when you tell people that their emotions actually have a stamp of approval from scientists, There's no stopping it. There's just no stopping it. And now we've got the problem. It failed in a theoretical sense in 1981 when we started to see the research showing that this doesn't pan out when you check the data. But now in 2008, we actually had the practical failure. People have lost their retirement money. But now it's even harder for those who have adopted this ideology to accept their errors because they've caused more damage. The more damage they cause, the harder it is for them to reverse course. Now they feel they have to defend this. They have to shift attention elsewhere. They have to say the mistake was made somewhere else. But the amazing thing about all this is the big debate we're sort of having a question that's on the table is the free market going to survive? That sounds overly dramatic, and it may be that it is overly dramatic, but there are people asking that question. You know, it's going to survive in some form, but some people are talking about ideas being considered in Congress as being the new deal. They're saying we may totally restructure our economy and our political system as a response to what's happened. And my question is that such a smart thing to do, given that the passive investing error explains the entire problem? And I have a podcast on that. I think it was the last one I did. Irrational Exuberance explains everything. And it just goes through why you don't need any other explanations. You don't need to look at stimulus or Bernie Madoff or bank regulation or Freddie Mac or any of this sort of thing. All you have to look at is passive investing. If you understand that passive investing is wrong and that overvaluation is possible, there is such a thing as overvaluation. If you understand that, the next step would be to look at how overvalued the market is. And when you look at that, what you see is that the market was overvalued by three times fair value. And when the market is overvalued by three times fair value, that means that everybody who owned stocks had only one third of what they thought they had. In other words, the error in dollar terms was in the trillions. I did a back of the envelope calculation showing it to be about $16 trillion. Well, when you get the calculation wrong by $16 trillion, you throw the whole entire economy into a mess. That's why the banks couldn't figure out what to do. They had all this funny money floating around. And all of your checks and balances throughout the whole system break down under that kind of pressure. The regulators weren't doing their job, not because they're bad people, because there was $16 trillion in funny money, and they just couldn't do it. The lawmakers weren't doing their job, and the bankers weren't doing their job, and the stock advisors weren't doing their job. Nobody was doing their job, because we had $16 trillion of funny money. In other words, it's all attributable to passive investing. We don't have to look any deeper than that. That's the problem. But you can't talk about it, because it is intensely ideological. And part of what's driving me to this sort of podcast is I've come to the conclusion, I've of course first tried discussing this with my fellow middle class investors, people on discussion boards. And many of them are interested, but this 20% of dogmatics is going to shut it down no matter what you do. So then I turned to experts. I turned to people like Scott Burns and Bill Bernstein and John Bogle. And what I found with them is they acknowledge in a way that passive investing can't work. They're willing to acknowledge certain things, but they're not really willing to say things clearly. They drag their feet. They're reluctant. And I think the problem is I think it's cognitive dissonance. They know that there's problems. They know that this stuff doesn't really add up. But they can't accept how bad it is. They don't want to know. They don't want to know. The thought is just too terrifying to look at. And so I don't think we're ever going to get where we need to go by dealing with investing experts. I think we need to go outside or go over their heads, if you want to look at it that way. And I think where we may need to go, ultimately, I've tried a little bit, not enough, but I've tried a little bit the idea of connecting with people in the frugality community. There are a lot of blogs on the internet that advocate frugality, and all that valuation-informed indexing is a frugal way to invest. It's just saying it's investing for people who don't want to throw their money away. Passive investing says throw your money away. Don't worry about valuation. Just, you know, whatever the price is, just pay it. Don't worry, you know. That's the most unfrugal thing you could do. So I wanna try that route, but I'm a little concerned from early reactions I've gotten that a lot of people who are big on frugality, they don't consider themselves investing experts. They consider themselves maybe money management experts, but not investing experts. And they just assume the experts must know what they're talking about. So they're intellectually afraid. They're intimidated. They don't want to tackle it. And so the next route, if that doesn't work, would be to go to people with some political background. Because this has become a political problem. It's really dominating the political scene. You know, people don't say we're discussing the failures of passive investing today, but that's what's going on. All of the stock crash was caused by the errors in the passive investing model, the whole thing. And all of the economic crisis results from that. And so all of our politics today is focused on this problem, you know, that Eugene Fama made, this error that Eugene Fama made, you know, 30, 40 years ago, and all those who followed in his wake. And so the question we always come back to is why can't they just admit it? Why can't they put it on the table? Why can't they fix it? And the problem is that it isn't ideology. And what passive investing is saying is that the market always gets it right. And of course the market doesn't. You know, we don't need government regulation necessarily. But we do need a moderating influence. So what you have at times of bull markets is the market telling us crazy things. The market's saying, you know, the market is saying in January of 2000, the market is saying stocks are worth X, and the reality is they're worth one-third X. So the market is talking crazy talk. And what the passive investing people are saying is, oh, no, market's always right. Never question the market. Never, ever, ever question the market. The market's always right. Can't beat the market. Can't be smarter than the market. Market's always right. That's an ideological stance. And it's the investing equivalent of saying the free market is always right. What we heard in the days before the New Deal was the free market is always right. Don't get involved. Don't regulate. You know, an example would be antitrust laws or antitrust regulations. Antitrust regulations are aimed at breaking up monopolies. The problem is, presuming you like free markets, I think free markets are generally a good thing so long as they're properly regulated. But in the laissez-faire era, the idea was, you know, if one company owned all the railroads and they wanted to, you know, make the price 10 times higher, people would say, well, government can't do anything. Free market, allowed to charge whatever they want. And they could put all the farmers out of business. The farmers can't afford to ship their goods unless they pay these outrageous prices at which they can't make a profit. So which is the true free market? Is the free market the people who say we have to have antitrust rules to block monopolies? I consider that the free market response. That way the farmers have a free market and the railroad people have a free market. But the laissez-faire approach was no. If the free market, if he's charging, you know, $1,000 to ship, you know, a bushel of wheat or whatever it is, that's the free market. Must be right. Can't question it. Must be right. Must be efficient price. Can't be wrong. Don't question it. That's laissez-faire. And that's what passive investing is. Passive investing says, doesn't matter if you happen to notice that 5 years in a row we've had a stock return of 20-25% a year. You know, crazy increases in prices that can't possibly be economically justified. And if you say in response to that, look, I think we ought to lower our stock allocations, this is getting awful dangerous, the passive investing people say, oh, no, don't change your stock allocation. That would be timing the market. That's, no. You can't beat the market. The market's always right. See, we're reliving this drama that we lived, you know, that brought on the crash of the 20s, really. I think that's what's happening. There are ideas that get out in the world, and Americans tend to be practical people, middle-class Americans especially are practical people, and all people want is get to the chase. You know, tell me what I need to do to make money. So what a lot of people, what most middle-class investors want is, just tell me what to do with my money. But if the system doesn't work, what people are going to be telling you is going to be wrong. And in this system where you can't question passive investing, there's no moderating influence. Somebody starts giving crazy advice, and then the follow-up is even more crazy. And then the next person makes it even more crazy, but nobody ever tempers it. Nobody ever moderates it. Common sense is prohibited. And that's not an overstatement. I mentioned, I think it was in the last podcast, that what Mel Lindauer used to say, you know, I tried to get him. Mel Lindauer would run these smear campaigns against me. And I'd say, Mel, why does it upset you so much? I said, all I do is I report what the historical data says on safe withdrawal rates or on, you know, on the effective valuations on long-term returns. Why does this bug you so much? Lots of people like it. Lots of people say they love my stuff. Why does it bug you so much? And sometimes he wouldn't answer. But one time, I think somebody else asked him, and he was willing to give an answer, and he says, Rob is dangerous. He's dangerous. And you know, you almost have to laugh. He was advocating the old school safe withdrawal rate studies back at the top of the bull market. The old school safe withdrawal rate studies were saying it was safe to take a 4% withdrawal for retirees. And if the number was calculated accurately, it was 2% was the safe withdrawal rate. So they were off by 2 full percentage points. Millions of people are going to suffer busted retirements in all likelihood because of those demonstrably false claims. And Mel was supporting the people making the false claims. He thought they were just great. He had no problem. He cites them in his book. But he said Rob is dangerous because Rob gave the accurate numbers. Why is that dangerous? See, yet we have to make sense of that. And I think the answer is it wasn't dangerous to the retirees who were looking for accurate numbers. It wasn't dangerous to stock investors. It was dangerous to passive investing advocates because I was showing the flaws of this model. I was showing how not so it is that this model justifies giving demonstrably false numbers to people planning their retirements. And look, Mel Lindauer didn't wake up one day and say, starting today, I'm going to do everything I can to destroy as many retirements as I can. Okay? That never happened. So, a question we have to ask ourselves is, how did Mel ever get so caught up in this that he started advocating, that he became so defensive? And the answer is, it's an ideology. He believes in passive investing. It's his life. You know, he's written a book about it. It's important to him. And he knows the weaknesses. He's been in enough of these discussions. He knows where the weak spots are. And Rob Bennett, you know, one thing I'll say in Mel's behalf, Rob Bennett's a relentless individual. You know, I was kind about it, and I was polite, always. I was charitable, always. I tried to be. But I'm relentless. I'm like a dog with a bone. I didn't let it drop. My view was every time a thread came up where somebody mentioned one of those old school studies, I was going to put up a post saying they've been found to be analytically invalid. Now, if people agreed, that was fine. And if people disagreed, that was fine. But I was going to put up a post saying that so that it was on the record. And I made that a practice and I followed it to the extent of my abilities. And that's why I was dangerous. But see, the root problem here is it shouldn't have been an issue. If passive investing were just a strategy like other investing strategies, then nobody would care. People would say, you know, Mel would just laugh. He'd say, oh, Rob, there you go again. You know, you've got your idea. I've got mine. My good friend, Rob. And that's how I always tried to act to him and to all other passive investing dogmatists. I always tried to, you know, treat them as friends. But they don't want to be treated as friends. They see me as an enemy because I don't buy into the ideology. It's not an investing strategy. It's an ideology. And if you question it, if you question the idea that the market gets the price right, there's no end of it. Their fear is if they let that foot in the door, if they allow people to question it, it'll never stop. And they're right. It won't ever stop. What I say is that instead of having years of discussions about whether we will allow questioning of passive investing or not, that should have been settled in one day. And what we should have been spending all our time on is how much should we change our stock allocations in response to prices? Not whether we should or not. That question's crazy. We should be saying how much. So Mel is right that I pose a threat. I want to change the debate about stock investing in a dramatic way, in a fundamental way. I want the debate to be how much should we change our stock allocation and when should we change our stock allocation, not should we. And as long as passive investing remains dominant, the question is should we. And when rational investing becomes dominant, the question is how much and when. But I think it helps, you know, it helps to know, I've said passive investing is the enemy, it helps to know what it is we're up against, what kind of enemy it is. And it's an ideological enemy. It's not an investing strategy that differs from some other strategy. There are all kinds of strategies that fall under the heading of rational investing, you know, value investing, momentum investing, you know, technical analysis. They all can be stock picking, indexing, they all can be rational. But passive investing cannot be rational. Because passive investing is an ideology. It's something you believe or not. It's a question of faith. It's not something you do based on data or based on reasoning or based on logic. It's something you have faith in. And this comes up all the time. People will talk about those boards, and they will say, "Oh, they're cultish." They say they're a cult. But all passive investing is cultish. The idea is cultish. It's not that the people are bad. There are lots of good people at those boards. Lots of them. But the idea is cultish. The idea that we don't need to change our stock allocations when prices change dramatically is a cultish idea. It always will be. So what I'm really trying to do in the podcast is to set the terms of the debate. To identify the nature of the enemy. The enemy is not an investing strategy. The enemy is an ideology. You know, all of us, as I say, all of us have ideologies. So I don't say that ideology in itself is bad. It's extremism that's bad. And you know, all of us I think everyone alive has changed his or her views on something over the course of his or her lifetime. That's what we all need to keep in our mind. We need to say, could I be wrong? And if I could be wrong, shouldn't I pull back a little bit and not state things too strongly? That's what the passive investing advocates never do. They never pull back. They always say that they're scientific. They, you know, as I say, many followers of passive investing don't do this, but the dogmatists always do this. And the experts, frankly, do this. And that's what needs to change. We need to get to an environment where the even advocates of passive investing can acknowledge that maybe they're wrong. Maybe they don't know everything. And once we get there, it's okay if they believe in it, as long as they allow other people to speak. That's the change we need to see. We need passive investing to become a strategy like all other strategies and not an ideology. Now, one last thing I wanted to tie in, and I've going over time again, but there's two big problems we've had during the 7 years of discussions. One is this ideology over passive investing, the investing ideas, the substance ideas. The other is the problem on the internet that people have adopted this idea that on the internet anything goes. And even though at all discussion boards there are rules for how the discussions will be conducted, there are rules for what can, you know, how you have to present yourself, and certain things are not permitted, threats and this sort of thing. And we've never been able to get site owners to administer those rules in a reasonable way. because the majority supports passive investing, and of course it does, in a wild bull market, the majority is always going to support the most emotional approach available. We need the board owners to be willing to say, look, passive investing dogmatists, you're not allowed to threaten to kill people. You know, that drives people off the board. That destroys the board. And we can't permit that. But we haven't found anyone willing to do that. Morningstar wasn't willing to do it. Bogleheads.org hasn't been willing to do it. Motley Fool hasn't been willing to do it. Index Universe hasn't been willing to do it. Early Retirement Forum hasn't been willing to do it. And that, I think, is another example of this liberty. I've always been looking for what's the connection between the two. It seems like too much of a coincidence that these two extremely strange things have been going on. This blind adherence to passive investing, which the historical data does not support, and this intense belief that there's nothing wrong with smear campaigns, there's nothing wrong with death threats, there's nothing wrong with deliberate deception. All these tactics are fine. There's nothing wrong. Both of these ideas are just crazy Looney Tunes ideas. And yet I've seen them both, and I've seen them work in combination. I've never seen these tactics used by anyone other than the passive investing dogmatist. I know that on other discussion boards they are, but I only participate on personal finance boards, and I've never seen anything like this outside of the debates about passive investing. So I have to believe there's some connection, but it's hard figuring out what is the connection. You know, crazy rules for administering internet discussions and crazy rules for how to set your stock allocation. What's the common theme? The common theme, I think, is this ideology, this libertarian ideology. Libertarian, as I say, I like many of their ideas. Libertarians have a fresh take on things, and you can learn a lot by reading libertarian literature. But there's a, you know, John Walter Russell had a phrase one time when he was talking about the problems on the discussion boards, the abuse of posting. He said, this is mob rule. In other words, there are a group of people that want to have a discussion, but there's also this mob that doesn't want it to go forward, and this mob will just engage in any tactic imaginable to shut the discussion down, and nobody does anything. It's mob rule, and he's right. It summed it up perfectly. Mob rule, I think, is characteristic of the libertarian political philosophy. There are libertarians, and as I say, I never was a card-carrying libertarian, but I did, I did read a lot of the literature, and I did associate with some libertarians. I had friends who were libertarians, and in the libertarian community, there's a tendency toward anarchy. There are libertarians when they get extreme enough, as I say, they oppose things like. Well, the libertarians are famous for arguing that drugs should be legalized. You know, that's common. But they argue for things like doing away with the antitrust laws. They argue, some libertarians will argue there should be no taxes. Some libertarians argue there should be no military. Some get pretty darn close to advocating anarchy. Now, obviously, many are not that extreme. You know, that's the extreme. But it is characteristic. And I think what happened, I think historically what happened, for reasons I don't fully understand, but I do to some extent, the internet, of course, was something new. It's come into our lives in recent decades. And libertarians have never had the numbers. They've always been they run candidates for office. They run a presidential campaign, but they usually don't get more than 1% of the vote. They're obviously tiny compared to the Democrats and Republicans. But there are many more libertarians around than people realize, because one of the reasons they can't get many votes for a candidate is the Democrats and Republicans have set up barriers. They've made it very hard to get candidates on the ballot. So if it were a level playing field, the libertarians would get much higher vote percentages. So there's a lot of sympathy for libertarian ideas, and there's never been an outlet. And the internet came along, and I think there's a connection between high tech and libertarian thinking. I don't know exactly why. I think there must be people interested in high tech. Those were the people that went on the internet first. And obviously they have engineering type personalities. And I think there's a real connection there, engineering-type personalities and libertarianism. And part of the reason I say that is that Ayn Rand herself, she loved engineering. She really should have been an engineer. She just loved engineering. You could tell. She loved math. She studied math. She studied chess. She wanted to be like a math professor. That was something she wanted to do if she hadn't been a novelist. I actually think, you know, I ponder all sorts of questions. Why her books had such great word of mouth. And I think what went on is that she was an engineer personality stuck in a non-engineer field. Fiction writing is not filled with the engineering type personality. And I think that's why she got bad reviews on her books so often. A lot of the people who reviewed the books could not relate to this engineering stuff. And she wrote novels, but she wrote them from the mind of a person with a sort of engineering, a love for these sorts of things, mathematics and things. And, you know, practical, tangible, concrete thinking, all this sort of thing. Logic. She loved logic. You know, which engineers love logic. But novelists often don't. Novelists are often much more into feeling and impressions and subjectivism. And emotions, you know. And so she wrote these books, and I think there's a great untapped part of the readership, the reading public, that are interested in books like Ayn Rand wrote, but they don't get many books like that. So when somebody came along doing it, they all spread the word amongst themselves, and the book caught on like wildfire, but the critics couldn't figure out what was going on, because to the critics, this stuff was junk. I think another type of book that those people might like, I say those people, I'm not in that group, I don't mean to be critical, I'm just, my mind doesn't work that way, would be science fiction. I think that might be another genre that appeals to that group. So science fiction books can have great popularity among a certain group of the populace, but are generally not giving outstanding critical reviews. I think that's part of what happened with Ayn Rand. And what I'm saying is that the same group of people, it's a percentage of the population, I don't know if it's 10% or what it is, they settled on the internet in the early years, and they were able to build things on the internet and to communicate on the internet with others of like mind. And I know when I used to post on the Motley Fool board that there were the population of libertarians was much greater than in the general public. So I think this group, they see themselves almost as a family, you know, the similar thinking people. And they settled on the internet, and they said, you know, how are we going to make the rules for participation on the internet? And their idea was very different than what the general public would have favored. Their idea was mob rule, because the mob was them. You know, they liked the mob was them, so they always won. They could drive off everyone else. And I think what's happened is that the internet has grown to where all types of other people are using the internet to conduct business, and this isn't going to fly. Not that we need to, I certainly don't want to remove the engineering personalities, but they're going to have to be more accommodationist. They're going to have to acknowledge that the whole thing doesn't belong to them. And that's really, we have this strange situation where the rules for these big sites like Motley Fool and Morningstar, the rules are just the normal rules you would expect. The rules make perfect sense. But the enforcement is all done to appeal to these, you know, I'm tempted to call them tech heads, and I don't mean any criticism. I don't mean any slight. And the tech heads are not, you know, they're not always, again, I mean no slight, but they're not always the most articulate. They're not always the most polite. They're not always the most soft. All these things. They have their own personalities and they have a place, but they can't continue to be dominant. But I think what we have is in both of these questions, on the substance side, on the process side, it's sort of a tech head personality that came up with the passive investing concept. And no, none of the non-tech heads question it because they're all intimidated. They're all frightened. They think that the tech heads know things. They don't know as much as they think they know. But they think that the tech heads believe they know it, and the non-tech heads believe the tech heads know it. They're just all wrong. And then when it gets to the internet and you're challenging them, they freak out and they resort to mob rule because they've used this to block discussions on other questions. And they're good at it. And they love it that they have a little universe that they can control. But my point on all this is, you know, I never intended to get involved in any of this. I never intended to take on any of these battles. I got thrown into it, you know, by circumstances. But I love a lot of these tech heads. I've learned from them. So, you know, I'm friends with them. But I love the others too. I love people that have other things to say. And I want all of our communities to be open to all sorts of points of view. And so I think we need to cut back on the ideology stuff. We need to cut back on this ideology that the internet can be run by mob rule. I think that's an unmitigated disaster. And I think we need to cut back on the ideology that people who see problems with overvaluation should not be advising middle-class investors to lower their allocations at times of insanely dangerous prices. Passive investing must be challenged. And to challenge it is to challenge an ideology. And if it upsets people, that's just too bad. It has to be challenged. If it hurts their feelings, that's an indication that there's a problem. It's an indication there's a problem. That's not really a strategy. It's an ideology. And we need it to be a strategy. If passive investing is going to survive, it needs to be downgraded or upgraded, depending on your point of view, to a strategy. Not an ideology. Good luck with your investing strategies. You take care.